Well, good evening, everyone. Ed is funny. He told me right before I walked up, you have to follow Annette Kirk. And he kind of chuckled and said, good luck. And I'm happy to do that, very happy. Annette, I would count as one of my closest friends, and I'm very proud to count her as one of my closest friends. I want to say thanks to a number of people, to Bill Campbell for inviting me tonight and for organizing all of this, and Julie, I think she's not in the room right now, but for having me. I started making a list of all the people I should thank. I see Christian Kopf over there and all these people that I haven't seen for a while, even got to meet people that I've talked with several times on Facebook, but have never actually met. So there was real community tonight, and I started making a list. And it got really long. So I just hope all of you who know me, you know that I'm glad to see you. It's great. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to share with you what I've learned going through a lot of the papers, diaries, and so forth of Russell Kirk over the last couple of years, 3 years now that I've been doing this. I do want to point out, I don't know where he's sitting, but I want to point out Winston Elliott, especially, who's been encouraging me for 18 years to do this. So thank you, Winston, wherever you are. Certainly, I would not be able to give this talk without your encouragement over the last 18 years. So tonight, I must admit, I never met Dr. Kirk. I never knew him. It's one of my great regrets in life. I don't have many. As you heard, I have 7 kids, so no regrets there. So far, they've been great. We'll see. The oldest just turned 14, so things could change. But at this point, no regrets. They've really been quite wonderful. But I do regret that I never got to meet Dr. Kirk. And in college, during the late 1980s, I read The Conservative Mind. In fact, I would say I devoured it and loved it. I wrote Dr. Kirk a very, very long letter about why I thought he was wrong on so many things, and I never sent it. And I regret that now, because I think he probably would have been quite gentle with me in all kinds of ways, and it might have struck up some kind of friendship. But my argument at the time was coming from a very strong libertarian perspective, and the argument was, Dr. Kirk, how is it that you get this idea of virtue so well, but you don't understand that people have to freely choose it? I think he did understand that, and I think that was an important part of his own thought, but certainly in the 1980s, when I was an undergraduate, this was very important to me, and I did write the letter, never sent it, and who knows what would have happened had I have sent it. Now that Annette has graciously allowed me to go through his letters, which there's no possibility that I could go through all of them. His work is just overwhelming. I don't even think Annette has gone through all of them. There's so much, and so much still. It's the best archives I've ever seen, frankly, and I've been through a lot. I'm 46 now, and I've spent 21 years or more, 26 years actually, going through archives, and it's the best collection of papers I've encountered anywhere. Better than the Tolkien papers, the Lewis papers, better than the Christopher Dawson papers, better than what I've seen at the Library of Congress, at least through certain characters who are there, certain figures. These are amazing. And he wrote to so many people, had correspondence with so many people. At times it tired him. I found letters, and I think we all know that, at least from reading about Kirk, he was prone to exaggerate certain things at times. But he would talk about in his letters that he was 300 letters in a arrears, and he had to correct that. And there were certain days that he would answer, he said, 180 letters. And that is possible, actually. There's some very interesting things about Kirk that are not widely known. One, I think he probably had a photographic memory. In fact, I would be shocked if he didn't, mostly because of his ability to just write, his ability to cite things that he had not looked at for 30 years without mistake. And I can say that having looked through his letters, this is something else that has astounded me, there's probably, and he typed everything, he hated writing, almost, I would say maybe 1 out of every 500 letters has a typo in it. They are flawless, not only in grammar, but of course the level of vocabulary is very high. The ideas that are in them are very high. Sometimes there are social things. He loved talking about his children. He loved talking about whatever tree he had just planted or some weird thing. Of course, he had an eye for the weird things that he had seen in McCoster or elsewhere. But generally, his letters were of a very, very high nature. So what I wanted to talk about tonight, because Dr. Foldner also told me, please remember, Brad, these are not Hillsdale students, and you do not have 50 minutes to speak, and they really want to go drink and probably don't want to listen to everything you have to say about Russell Kirk. So I thought, well, all right, that seems very fair. So I narrowed this down to 5 things that I would like to say in my time allotted about Dr. Kirk and why I think those five things, especially going back to what Dr. Follner said at the very beginning, that we need to think about how is it that we're going to bring the movement back together? How is it that we can think about our own ideas, our own position within a larger understanding of what we might call the right or conservatism or libertarianism? And I think that there are things that Kirk can add that can allow us to kind of come back to our first principles and to the ideas of right reason. So let me begin by talking about a moment that I think was very important in Kirk's life. But it's a moment that he never really talked about in print. You only find it in his letters and diaries. As many of you may know, in 1948, he left the United States and went to Scotland for 4 years. He returned now and then. He taught a class at Michigan State now and then. But he generally had permission just to be gone during that time to earn his D.Lit in Scotland. And while he was there, he really discovered a lot of things about himself in those years. It was when he first fell in love with Burke. He had encountered Burke earlier, but it was in the 1940s, the late 1940s in Scotland, that he really grasped onto this. But he also started writing his very famous ghost stories, which I think we've forgotten, and in many ways we shouldn't, because these tell us a lot about Dr. Kirk's ideas, about the moral imagination, and about eternity. And some very interesting things that come up in his letters, so I'll mention two while he was in Scotland. The first is he describes what it was like to go and to visit the cathedral in York. And his description of what the cathedral was like was really breathtaking. Because here he is, he's only about 31 at the time that he visits. Annette said that he died with a very strong faith, but his faith did not come easily to him. He struggled with it immensely. Going from basically letters in 1942 where he said, I think probably of everything I've read, the Catholic Church seems to be the most correct, but the closer it gets to truth, the more I want to run away from it. And it was very difficult for him to assent to any kind of Orthodox faith, though he loved the idea of orthodoxy. He really just could not believe. And it took a very long time. It really wasn't until about 1954, when he started taking instructions from a Jesuit, Hugh O'Neill, in Detroit, that he really started accepting a lot of Catholic doctrine. But of course, wouldn't accept any of that formally until August of 1964, 10 years later, about a month before he married Annette. Then he was baptized as Russell Amos Augustine Kirk, and I think that's very telling. And his faith grew. But even as Annette has said in private, and I think importantly, that even on his deathbed, he always kept Marcus Aurelius and the Meditations next to Scripture. They were both comforts for him, and I think that stoicism of Kirk is very important. But let's go back to 1951 in the fall, where he goes to the York Cathedral. And when he's sitting in there, he has kind of, and Kirk often had interesting experiences. He had a moment. And in that moment, he thought that he could see what it had been like to be in there with the Cavaliers as they were being bombarded by the Roundheads, and as they sat in that cathedral and sang the Te Deum as they were just about to be slaughtered. Now, that's an interesting image. That's an image, I think, that speaks so much of Kirk's romantic nature. It speaks of his love of lost causes. And Christopher Dawson, another one of my heroes, has said that any native English speaker loves lost causes. It's a part of our language. It's a part of our heritage. You know, there's a reason that we call William the Bastard, and we still remember Harold of Hastings as a fairly interesting guy, even though he lost. There's something in the British mindset, I think, that does tend towards these ideas of lost causes. So Kirk imagined this, and it was an awakening for him. After this, he met a canon Smith, who was a very interesting man in England. He got to know him. He was quite taken with the ideas of orthodoxy, and he began to learn. But again, this was very slow for him. But as I think about that and that idea of him sitting in 1951 in that cathedral and imagining that, it's hard not to make the comparison to Gibbon in Rome or to Dawson in 1909, Easter, where he was standing in Rome, and suddenly he claimed that he had a vision of every single historical moment in a flash, and that God had asked him to spend his life recording these things. And He suffered depression, anxiety, because he could never live up to that, but he spent his life trying. Kirk didn't suffer from those things, but I do think that there was a real sense in that moment that Kirk understood this was something that had to be explained. And it also helps us understand why he loves Elliot so much. Elliot, who loved Little Gidding, because Little Gidding is where Charles went for sanctuary before he too was beheaded. There's some really interesting connections in all of this, and I think that comes out, at least in that moment, in 1951. But the other thing that struck me in his letters, and there are a lot of things, he talks about how intelligent the average Scot is at St. Andrews compared to what he experienced when he was at Duke or at Michigan State. He's quite intimidated. When he was at Michigan State, he wasn't intimidated at all, but he was when he was in Scotland, because he was pretty stunned at the average classical education that most Scots had, at least at the time. But a couple of the letters I love, and this is the other thing I wanted to mention about his time in Scotland, there are moments where Kirk is so poor, and of course he grew up in poverty, but there are moments where he is so poor that he is wondering how he's going to be able to feed himself the next day as a graduate student in Scotland. And there are moments where he has to sell his clothing because he really cannot afford even a breakfast. And then he decides, and this something awakens in his imagination, he decides he's going to write a short story. And he does, and he sends it off to a new magazine, and within a day they respond and say, "This is one of the most interesting things we've ever seen. We'd like to offer you £100 for it." That's a lot of money in 1951. That may have been more money than Kirk had ever had in his life. And of course, this is how he put himself through St. Andrews. And we don't remember that about him. We often forget, or we say, oh, well, there's Russell Kirk, the cultural thinker and the political thinker. But Russell Kirk was very famous in his own day and age. Some people have even argued, very effectively, I think, that there wouldn't be a genre, now whether Kirk would be happy about this or not, there wouldn't be the genre of horror in the way that we understand it now without some of the things that Kirk wrote in the 50s, and especially with his first novel, Old House of Fear. It's probably even possible, and Kirk admits this as well in his autobiography, that there would not be a Stephen King. And having read a number of Stephen King's books, and I'm not necessarily proud of that, but having done that, I can say that there are times where Kirk is just as dark as King ever would be. And there are very dark moments in Kirk's fiction, but also, of course, brilliant moments, just beautiful in all kinds of ways. But Kirk really did, I think, live what he attempted to preach as the good life. He wanted to write. He wanted to be a part of these various circles. And these were the ways that he encountered those things. So let me mention these five things that I think are just astounding about Dr. Kirk. Number one, I don't think I can ever get over how many things he published in his lifetime. Pre-internet, all with a typewriter, traveled everywhere he could with his typewriter, his portable typewriter, and this was just a part of his life. And as I put, probably Ingrid thought I was just utterly bizarre when I gave her an application for Earhart, and I said, the only way I can explain this is Kirk must have had a mystical third limb, right? Something like a third arm. How did he ever write as much as he did? We think about all the books he published, all of the articles he published. He wrote a regular column between 1962 and 1975 that was syndicated. He wrote for National Review. Sometimes he was writing five or six columns a week. Plus, this is in addition to his stories, many of which were never published. And one of the things that I find interesting going through the Kirk papers, there were so many books that were started or completed, and they never found a publisher. Books like The Fulminations of a Nocturnal Bookman. That's a great title. Who wouldn't want that book? But it's just sitting there in the Kirk Library because it never found a publisher. And there are a number of stories like this, children's stories that Kirk started or wrote or that his children still remember, but they never was able to publish them in his own lifetime. But as Wesley MacDonald has said, and I think quite effectively, it is quite possible that Kirk wrote more in his lifetime than the average intelligent American reads in his lifetime. And that is probably true. We can't imagine a Dr. Kirk without that incredible output. Number two, I think very importantly about Dr. Kirk, especially as we think about our own position today, our position as those, again, to use this term broadly, on the right, those of us who reject the ideologies and fantasies of the left, Kirk was always his own man. In every way, He was his own man. Sometimes he was frustrating. And I'm sure people who had to deal with him did not always find him the easiest person to deal with. And I know many of you knew him, and you probably have great stories about him. But Kirk was his own man. He did his own thing. When he felt that the president of Michigan State was lowering standards, he quit. And he made public national news about this. This was not the only time he did this. Repeatedly in his lifetime, he challenged what he believed to be inhumane. And one of the things that I find in his letters that I think probably speaks as well about Kirk's character as anything else, this was a man who hated injustice. He hated it in every form. He, no matter how much he might talk about classes and ranks and how we need to aspire to those things, when push came to shove, Kirk was his own man, and in part because he hated injustice, and he wanted to fight those things. And you see that in the way he treats people, very much so. Whether he's debating with Norman Thomas, someone that he disagreed with dramatically, or Malcolm X, he always finds in his opponent something worthy of being humane, something that he can attach some value of goodness to. And you see this again over and over again in his letters. And I have to quote John Wilson, who I don't think is here, but John Wilson, former president of Philly Sock, who said there were so many people in Kirk's life who tried to manage him, and Kirk got away from every one of them. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, and it speaks well of him. Number three, I think one of the reasons that we don't talk about Kirk as much as maybe at one time we would have, and especially if you look at the memoirs of Barry Goldwater, Goldwater says quite clearly that there were really two thinkers in his life that shaped him, Friedrich Hayek and Russell Kirk. And he said that repeatedly throughout his life. And I think there's no accident about that. Certainly there would not have been a Goldwater movement without that backing of Kirk, at least intellectually giving it a respectability, all the way back to about 1958, 1959. But this is the third thing I want to say about Kirk, and I think this is where probably a lot of modern conservatives have a problem with him. And I can understand that. I can see why this would be a frustration. Kirk was never, and he would have rejected the very idea of being a systematic thinker. Never would he have been a systematic thinker. In his desire to fight ideology, quite often he would fight anything, libertarianism, neoconservatism. Often his attacks on those were not personal. They were in the abstract, and they were really towards the idea of a mere conservatism, much like Lewis's mere Christianity. Not a desire to attack the person attached to those labels, but to attack those labels as dangerously narrowing. We can agree or disagree with him on that, but I do believe that for the most part, his intent was quite good and quite strong. But he was a dogmatic thinker, not a systematic thinker. And I mean dogma here in its proper sense. Kirk believed that there were very serious limitations to our understanding of things. There were only certain things we could know. And therefore, we accepted those limitations. And so we may look out into the world, and we may be able to see A and B and E, but for some reason, because of our own limitations or because these things have become obscured in history, we miss C and D. But we don't reject them. We just simply acknowledge we don't know these things yet. We might. But at this point, we don't know them. And so we have to accept in humility there are certain things we don't know. And this is why when we read Kirk, there are moments where, yes, he probably does contradict himself. Maybe the Kirk of 1954 is not quite the Kirk of 1993, but he is also one of the best read persons I've ever encountered. He reads, he thinks, he brings all kinds of new concepts into his own understandings, and he falls in love with certain things. Towards the end of his life, he was working diligently on a book on justice. He was trying to answer Rawls. Of course, he died before he was able to accomplish that, but it was meant to be kind of an honor of Josef Pieper and an attack on Rawls itself. This was not something the Kirk of the 1950s would have been interested in. Not at all. But by the 1990s, he wanted to examine this, and he thought it was a necessary issue. And so when we look at Kirk, I think most appropriately on this third point, that he is a dogmatic rather than a systematic thinker, I think we probably have to agree with one of his critics, Walter Burns, who said in 1954, Kirk may have a very good imagination, but he's not a good political thinker. And there is something to that. Kirk, I think, ultimately had the mind of a poet rather than a philosopher. Now, that's not a knock on him. Poets will be remembered. As Cicero tells us, the poet who plants the tree will have the tree there forever, whereas the farmer who does will only have it for a few hundred years. So this is not to knock, by any means, the poetic imagination. But I do think that when Kirk writes, he does so as a poet more than as a philosopher. Number four, I am astounded by Kirk's friendships in so many things. Things that we, because of our own divisions within the right, we don't accept. One of Kirk's greatest figures, a person he admired deeply, was Leo Strauss. He went to Chicago to visit with Strauss. He promoted Strauss's works wherever he could. He based his book, Academic Freedom, entirely on Strauss's natural right in history. So when we talk that there's a division between the Straussians and those who embrace Kirk, well, that's our division. That was not their division. They liked each other. They consulted one another. Strauss even said to Kirk, in a private letter, "You are probably one of the most interesting and well-read persons I've ever encountered." This is high praise. And Kirk respected that. And I think one of the things, and this will be point number five, and I'll conclude on this, that we have to understand about Kirk is that Kirk genuinely defended not only justice, but also justice in the human person. One way that I've tried to explain this with my colleagues at Hillsdale, and also with people like Winston Elliott in great discussions, Kirk had an awful humanity about him. And I mean that in the best sense. I mean that he had a deep respect for the human person. And I think it would be wrong to label him as anything other than really a personalist. This is what he was. He deeply desired to know the human person. He desired to examine the human person. We're here, in a sense, celebrating the conservative mind. What is the conservative mind if not a collection of various people who had great thoughts that he respects and has put together? We could, as Gerald Rosello has called it, postmodern. I think there's an element of that. I think Jerry's absolutely right. But in that narrative, we have at one end Edmund Burke, perhaps one of the greatest figures of his day. Certainly next to Washington, I think we could call him one of the great contenders of the best men of his day. And at the other end, we have T.S. Eliot. No accident, a poet and a cultural critic, and a man who became one of Russell Kirk's closest friends, and he considered Kirk a very good friend as well. Again, this is not widely known, but it's clear in the letters, Eliot is the one who asked Kirk to write the book on him. He wanted Kirk's understanding of himself. He thought that Eliot in his age could only be written by Kirk, because Kirk understood Eliot perhaps better than any other figure of his day. I call that high praise. And yet, that's not the only friendship. Kirk had friendships with Barry Goldwater, with Robert Nisbet, with Peter Stanless, with Ray Bradbury, with Jerry Purnell. So many figures in the cultural realm, those who were really moving and shaking. And I got to sit next to one of them tonight, Ed Fulner. We can't imagine the Heritage Foundation without, at least in part, Russell Kirk's influence on that. And so in so many ways, we have this idea, we have this real understanding, I think, of what Kirk offered, but we often forget that he was the one who offered it to us. We've accepted so much of what he taught as common wisdom, and the rest we've often forgotten. But again, just a couple of things on this point of his awful humanity that I don't think are widely known, but should be. He, more than anything else of his day and age, especially as a young man, despised the internment of Japanese Americans. This bothered him to no end. He went to Minidoka, Idaho, and when he was there, he saw terrible things during the internment of Japanese Americans. This affected him deeply for his whole life. When he wrote The Conservative Mind, part of his conservatism was an attempt to overcome the kinds of ideas that would allow that. He was deeply moved as well by the dropping of the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. In fact, I would be willing to debate and claim that there was probably nothing else in his life outside of his own marriage and his fatherhood and his conversion that affected him as much as his reaction to the dropping of those bombs. He was horrified by them. And we may argue whether it was right or wrong, but Kirk, living at the time, was terrified that he belonged to an army that had sanctioned this, that he belonged to a government that had sanctioned it. He founded, and again, something not widely known, he founded Modern Age as a defense of Leo Strauss because Strauss was being attacked for being Jewish. He quit Modern Age in 1960, because he believed that the editorial board had become anti-Semitic. Now, this is Russell Kirk. How often do we like to bring up what was said in 1987 about him? It's wrong. It's just dead wrong. And you can see that in his letters and how much he tried to promote. Or how about this? In 1973, Kirk had to wrestle with himself whether or not to go out to Wounded Knee to help the Sioux Indians in their fight against the FBI. Again, this is not the Kirk we remember. This is not the stuffy Kirk that we often think of with the conservative mind. This was a deeply caring, a deeply humane man. So let me finish with this. This is one of the things that I think is most important about Kirk. One of the reasons he's so important is because, in a sense, he's unimportant. Russell Kirk would be the last person to put himself in the tradition of the greats, even if what Annette read is true, and it was, and it's beautiful. Kirk did not want the focus on himself. Part of what he did so often, and one of the things that is clear from reading any one of his works, he always gave credit where credit was due. He always praised. And yes, he quoted, and people found that off-putting. But it wasn't because he was cocky. It was because he was giving credit to these great thinkers. He was talking to them. He was conversing with them. And he's asking us to do the same. He wants us to converse as well. So how many labels would we want to give Kirk? What would we want to call him? As a young man, he loved Albert J. Nock and Isabel Patterson. As a more mature man, it was T.S. Eliot and Christopher Dawson. He never forgot Nock. He did forget Patterson. He never forgot Nock. That was always still there. And even if you look at the various editions of the conservative mind, they move through his own understanding of what conservatism is. But if you remember his last piece of advice, and those of you who knew him, you knew this is what he said all the time. Sure, think great thoughts, engage the greats. But in the end, what does it come down to? It comes down to lighting the corner where you find yourself. It's really all you can do. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad. That was a spectacular introduction to our weekend and wonderful synthesis of why Russell Kirk is so central to what both the Philadelphia Society and I think to what everybody in this room thinks is not only the important things but also the permanent things. Ladies and gentlemen, we stand adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning. Coffee will be served at 8 o'clock. We are meeting here, this room, in this room. Have a good night. Thank you all.